good to see everyone here this morning. To our members, welcome. Let's keep in mind those that are not able to be with us. Keep them in our prayers and in our thoughts. So look around, see who's not here. And let's find out why they're not here to express some care for them, some concern for them. To our visitors, want you to know you're our honored guests, that we're so glad that you're here. If you have any questions about anything that you see or hear, we would love to field any of those questions that you may have. If you think there's something that we're doing here that is in error, we would love to study with you. We seek to worship God, to please Him. He is our first and our foremost priority. So if there's something that we're not doing correctly, we would love to know about it. So please bring it to our attention. If you want any of the material furnished to you that you heard in Bible class or that you've heard in a sermon in times past or today, please feel free to ask. We would love to give you any material you may need. And now's your chance. My mother's in town, so if you want to give her a piece of your mind, you may now do that. So I'm glad she's here as well. Wanted to go ahead and acknowledge that. You may notice that the theme is going to be similar to that which was presented last week, and that's because we are going to look at the other half of our lesson. Last time, we looked at the fact that the Christ was deity, that He was God, and that He came here to this earth to fulfill the law, to see to our own salvation. What we're going to see in this lesson is not that He came, or not that He was God, so much as He was man. We're not denying that He was God. We're just affirming that He was also 100% man, just as He was 100% God. This is not an attempt to explain that relationship. Let's be clear on this. There is no way that I'm going to be able to explain how God can be God and man at the same time. We teach and we learn through patterns, through examples, and through experience. This, however, has never been done before. It will never be done again. Therefore, there is no pattern for it. There is no likeness. There's no illustration I can make to adequately show you how an individual, how an entity, can be both God and man at the same time. Because there is no pattern for it. He did it one time in this entire reality. Because of that, I'm not even going to attempt to explain to you how He can be both man and God at the same time. I would have an easier time explaining to you how water can be turned into wine, or how it can be turned into blood in the case of the 10 plagues, how a stormy sea could be stilled instantly. I'd have a better time, an easier time explaining how that works than to explain how somebody can be both man and God at the same time. I might as well try and explain to you how the dead are raised. How a man can be dead for several days and come walking or hopping anyway, he was bound, out of the tomb. I don't know what Lazarus looked like when he went in or when he went out. I know this, though. He rose from the dead. I'd have an easier time explaining those than how Jesus was both man and God at the same time. What we're looking at is something supernatural. I did not say paranormal. I said supernatural. That is, above the natural world. What we're looking at is a miracle. How God could manifest Himself in the flesh, be both man and God at the same time. With all of that in mind, what I do know is this, is that He was both man and God, because the Bible affirms both to be true. As we saw last time, He is God. We're going to see this morning, He is man. So let's look at our first point then, that Jesus was fully man while he was here on this earth. In John 1 and verse 14. John 1 and verse 14. John 1 and verse 14, it says this. From our text last week, it says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." That word that we looked at, that logos, that mediator that the Jews and the Greeks both speculated was there between us and God, between us and the gods in the case of the Greeks, we now are told that that is Jesus Christ. He became flesh. He dwelt among us. Emmanuel means God with us. And that is the name of Christ. He was here with us. Jesus was fully man while here on this earth. Jesus was commonly called, both referring to Himself and what others would have referred to him, he was known as the Son of Man. Ezekiel and Daniel were both referred to as Son of Man. In Daniel chapter 8, Daniel 8. In Daniel 8, in verse 17, it says this. You may be wondering why we're talking about Ezekiel and Daniel being called the Son of Man. Well, what we're seeing is that if we can find people who are not God called Son of Man, then we know then that if Jesus is also called the Son of Man, he must share some kind of relationship with them. In Daniel chapter 8 and verse 17, it says this. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, Son of Man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. He calls him directly Son of Man. He doesn't say, well, Son of Man, but not like Jesus kind of Son of Man. No, he's showing there's a relationship there. There's something in common between Ezekiel and Daniel and Jesus, that they are partakers of some kind of nature together. Ezekiel is called Son of Man no less than 89 times. And not one of those times is it in any kind of prophetic way. It refers to Ezekiel as the Son of Man. So who's the Son of Man? Is it Jesus? Or is it Ezekiel? Or is it Daniel? Who's the Son of Man? We also find that in other places in the Old Testament, the phrase is used several times to talk about men, to talk about humans, to talk about those of flesh and blood. In Numbers 23, verse 19... Numbers 23 and verse 19. Numbers 23 in verse 19, it says this. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do, or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Notice the relationship that it's making. God is not a man, nor is he a son of man. So what does son of man mean then? Well, you're told in the verse, son of man is a human. It is a child of Adam. It is a human being, a man. So whenever we read about Ezekiel and Daniel being called son of men, should that surprise us? No, not at all, because they're humans. They're men. They are flesh and blood. In Psalm 8, in verse 4, Psalm 8, the 8th Psalm, in verse 4, the 8th Psalm in verse 4. It says, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? And yes, although this would be a messianic psalm, it is going to be talking about Jesus. We're going to find that in Hebrews chapter 2. Listen to what it says. What is man, the son of man? Son of man means a human. It means a flesh and blood being. In 146, the other end of the book of Psalms, in the 146th Psalm, and look at the third verse with me, he would say this. Do not put your trust in princes, nor in a son of man, in whom there is no help. Well, if the son of man is Jesus, because after all, he's divine and that always refers to him. Well, it's telling me not to put my trust in the son of man. But what is it saying? Not to put my trust in humans. Not to put my trust in men. Why? Because they're going to disappoint me. That's what it's telling me. It is not telling me not to put my trust in Jesus. So we're finding then that this phrase, Son of Man, bears a relationship. And that's the point we're getting across. The title Christ ascribes to himself more than any other title is the Son of Man. In Mark 10, in verse 45, he said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. He refers to himself all the time as the Son of Man. Why? He's cluing us in about his nature. He's telling us something about him, that he is a partaker in flesh and blood with us. He is now our brother in that sense. And we find that in Hebrews 2. I'm alluding a lot to Hebrews 2 because we will be going to Hebrews 2 very, very quickly. Jesus was a man in physical composition. He was a man in the fact that he possessed flesh, blood, and bones. He was a human. In Luke 24 and verse 39. Luke 24 and verse 39. Luke 24. This is after Jesus was raised from the dead. So if the objection was raised, well, before his death, sure, he was flesh and blood. But after he rose from the dead, I mean, he was able to go straight through walls, straight through a closed locked door. So, I mean, even then, probably wasn't exactly flesh and blood, because flesh and blood can't do that. But Jesus affirms this to us. In Luke 24, in verse 39, he says, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see. For a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." John 4:24 says, God is a spirit. Those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. Jesus says, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see. For a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have." What a point are we making? That Jesus isn't God? On the contrary, we're establishing the point that not only is He God, He also took on the form, the being of a man, of a human. He possessed flesh, blood, and bones. He was born and He had to grow. In Luke 2, the other end of the book of Luke, Luke chapter 2 and verse 52. It's a short verse, but it contains, I believe, significant import into Jesus, His nature, and His life. In Luke 2 and verse 52. Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. He had to grow up. In Luke chapter 2, we read earlier in Luke chapter 2 about His birth. In Matthew chapter 1, we read about His birth. We're reading about the birth of Jesus. Well, He was born. We find in Galatians 4 and verse 4, listen to this, Galatians 4 and 4. He leaves little doubt in our mind that, yes, He was born a human, born a man. Not just born deity in flesh. Wasn't man, just God in flesh. No, He was a human. He was a person. He was a man, just like you and me. In Galatians 4 and verse 4, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law." He was born. He was fashioned just like you and me. There was nothing different in that sense. He partook of the same nature. We're going to see that again when we look at Hebrews chapter 2. He had the appetites of man. He had the appetites of man. In Luke 24 again, Luke 24, 42 and 43, He asks them, "Do you have anything to eat?" And they give Him a roll of fish, and you know what He does? He eats it. Well, does a spirit do that? In Acts 17, listen to this, Acts 17. Paul points out to the Athenians, he says in verse 24, "God who made the world and everything in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is He worshipped with men's hands, as though He needed anything." As though He needed anything. Would that include a broiled fish? But if He got hungry, like in Matthew chapter 4, 1 through 4, when He went out into the wilderness to be tempted by the tempter, and what is the first thing the tempter says? "Command that these stones would become bread." Well, what does it matter if you're God only because you don't suffer from hunger, right? You don't need anything from man's hands. You made everything. Unless He's also man. And if He's man, He would have the appetites of man. And if He's man, He's going to get hungry. And He's going to get thirsty. And, as we're going to find, He gets sleepy. In Mark 4, in verse 38, you know where He is? He's on a boat. And in that boat, there's a raging storm going on around Him. You know where Jesus was? In that boat? At the stern, asleep. Why was He asleep? Does God slumber? Does God sleep? Does He fall asleep on you when you pray? Well, if Jesus was a man and needed to sleep like humans do, well, it would make sense that He would be asleep. We find that He had not only that, but all of the appetites that would lead to temptation. In Romans chapter 8, Romans chapter 8, we referenced this passage in our morning Bible class. Romans chapter 8 and verse 3. Romans 8 and verse 3, it says this, "For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God did, by sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. And on account of sin, He condemned sin in the flesh." What does that tell me? That He was made in the likeness of sinful flesh? That He was made to be sin? That He was sin? No, not at all. Nor was He inherently sinful. What it's saying is, He had every appetite that the flesh is going to have that could lead us to sin. That's why it's called sinful, because it has various, all of these appetites that used unlawfully will lead us to sin. Christ had all of them. Let's be clear on that. He was tempted, just like you and I were tempted. In fact, let's move on to the fact that Jesus shared our temptation, that He shared our trials. He was tempted just like you and I are tempted. In order to be our mediator, in order to be the go-between, in order to be our intercessor between us and God, He had to be tempted like you and like me. So some say, well, He was God, so He wasn't tempted, He was tested. I don't care what you call it. It was whatever you and I go through, that's what Christ went through. Because if He didn't, we're going to find at the end of the lesson what it actually means if He didn't. What does it mean if He didn't actually become a man, being God, but also being man at the same time? What does it mean if He didn't become man? We're going to see that just a very short section on that. In Hebrews chapter 2, Hebrews 2, if you turn over there, Jesus shares in our trials and in our temptations. It's very important that He do this because in order to be our mediator, He had to share in these same temptations. In Hebrews 2, I want you to look at verse 11. It says this. Hebrews 2 and verse 11. For both He who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one. For which reason, He is not ashamed to call them brethren. What is He talking about? That He, the one who sanctifies, and those that are being sanctified are of one. What does that mean? Of one nature. They all are fellow partakers of the same nature, and that is humanity. They are all of flesh and blood. In verse 14, He answers what it is. Inasmuch as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, He Himself likewise shared in the same, that through death He might destroy him who had power over death, that is, the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For indeed He does not give aid to the angels, but He does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Therefore, in all things, He had to be made like His brethren. In all things. Not similar to it, but not. He was tested, not tempted. That's a word game. We're not here to play word games. We're here to see what God's Word has to say to us. And it's telling me in verse 17, therefore in all things He had to be made like His brethren. He had to be in order for what? That He might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that He Himself has suffered being tempted, not tested, He was tempted, He is able to aid those who are tempted. It is crucial that He undergo the same temptations because He now knows what we're going through. He underwent the same. He can sympathize with us because He knows what we face. In Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, Hebrews 4 and verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. The only difference between you and Christ, the only difference between me and Christ, is the fact that He didn't yield to temptation where I did. He didn't yield to temptation where you did. That's the difference. True, He is God, but He's also man and underwent all of the desires, all of the temptations, all of the lusts, all of the battles that being a man comes with or brings with it. But He did not yield to it. That is the difference. That is the difference. He can sympathize with us. He knows what we have undergone. Jesus also was fully man on this earth because He suffered and He died. He was not somehow exempt from this. In Hebrews 2 and verse 14 again, inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, He Himself likewise shared in the same. That what? That through death. Why did He take on flesh and blood? Because you cannot kill Him if He's not in flesh and blood. That's what Jesus would tell His disciples. He would say, don't fear those who can destroy the body, but then beyond that, there's nothing they can do. Fear instead Him who can destroy both the body and the soul in hell. He's telling me that if he didn't come in the flesh, and he can't die, if he can't die, then he can't offer himself as an adequate sacrifice for your sins and mine. It is imperative then that he was a man in the flesh, in the blood, in the bone. Because if he was not, then he cannot give us this sacrifice through death. That he can destroy him who had power over death itself, that is, the devil. He cannot release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. That's not a possibility if he was not here as a man in the flesh. As I said before, I'll say it again, we're not denying his deity by pointing this out. We're saying he was also 100% man, 100% human. God is not indifferent to human suffering. Jesus is not indifferent to human suffering because he knows it by experience. He went through this, and he did it not for kicks, to just see what it would be like. I mean, after all, I've been from eternity to eternity, so hey, I'll take a pit stop and see what life's all about. Not at all. He did this so he would know what you go through, what I go through, and that he can sympathize with us. So he knows, hey, that hurts. That's what suffering's like. So when they pray earnestly about alleviating suffering, I know what it's like. That's why he did this. So that we know we have a sympathetic high priest. We know we have somebody who listens and acknowledges that. How would it be if he didn't? It would be more like a individual, passive, indifferent, saying, well, deal with it. It's not really my problem, it's yours. You got yourself into this mess, I gave you my laws, you broke them, you caused suffering for yourself. Get over it. Find some way around it. Find some way to deal with it. But instead, we have a sympathetic high priest. We have someone who understands those weaknesses, who understands the temptations, who understands how much it hurts because he went through it. Well, did he undergo hunger? Yes, he underwent hunger. He, if you remember, was not in the upper echelons of society, was he? He was a carpenter in a town that where no good thing comes from. Nazareth, of all places, Nazareth. That's where he came from, where nobody even wanted to be around him. It was on the other side of Samaria, if you know what I mean. It was that bad. But that's what he was. He says the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man, there it is, the Son of Man, has nowhere to what? Lay his head. He had to get the tax, the temple tax, out of a fish's mouth. He didn't have all of the wealth of the world at his fingertips. He knows what it's like to undergo that. On top of that, he'll raise you one. Because he underwent scourging. He underwent the crucifixion. And medical experts, scientists today tell us that crucifixion would have been one of the most pain-ridden deaths that you can possibly experience. That of all of the ways that the Romans could have done it, that's the way they chose to do it. It was reserved for criminals, for the worst of the worst. It was reserved for the enemies of Rome. And they were making a point whenever they would crucify somebody, saying, this is what happens when you resist Rome. And they wanted to make sure that it was a painful ordeal. And Christ went through that for you and me. In Matthew 27, it's interesting to me that verse 26 is so short, but contains so much. Matthew 27, verse 26. It says, then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, delivered him up to be crucified. Well, there was no reason to go into detail on it. Because they understood what it meant to be scourged. They got to witness it. They could see it. It was done publicly to humiliate the one being beaten. And they would have known what it was. He needed to go into no more detail on it. But to be beaten with cords, to be beaten with leather straps, with bones, metal and rocks tied into it, that would literally flay the skin off their back. Do you realize not many people even made it to the cross because of this? They would just simply be beaten, and they're not restricted to 40 lashes minus one. You realize that? The Romans, under no law of Moses, could beat the individual as long as they had the strength to do it. And so Jesus is scourged and then delivered to be crucified. You want to talk about pain? Jesus knows what pain's like. God knows what pain's like. He's not indifferent to human suffering. And why doesn't God stop it today? Because we decide to perpetuate it. That's why. We choose to continue committing sin. We choose to continue making things worse. And if not us, our society. And if not our society, this world. Whichever you want to pick. We are in a vicious cycle of causing our own suffering. And whenever the gospel is presented, whenever Jesus says, here's the way, the truth, and the life, people say, that's an outdated book that's going to judge me. Well, you're in misery where you are. Why not alleviate a little bit of it? Jesus knows what it's like. He had to be a man to undergo death, and he did that for us. His brethren are fellow partakers of flesh. And that's us. He died. He suffered for us. So why does this matter? Why does it matter that Jesus is both God and both man at the same time? Why would that matter? Because if he wasn't actually tempted like we are, then he's not actually a faithful high priest who sympathizes with us. Because he doesn't actually understand what it was to go through this life. He didn't actually suffer on the cross. And if you can't kill him because he didn't have flesh, then he didn't actually die, which means he didn't actually rise from the dead, which means you have no hope of heaven, because you're not actually going to rise from the dead either. Since he never died and raised, you won't rise either. That's why it matters. It's ironic that a lesson like this, pointing out that Jesus was indeed just a man, would probably be accepted by the world. They probably would have no problem with it. I don't have to prove to the people out there that Jesus was just a man. That's what they say already if they think he actually existed at all. Although, it's kind of difficult to begin to understand why you would think Jesus did not even exist at all. But the world would take this and say, hey, okay, I don't have to prove to them that Jesus was just a man. I would have to prove to them last week's lesson that Jesus was indeed God. That's the lesson that they would struggle with. Because if he's God, you have to listen to him. You have to heed his word. Because he will judge them in the last day. However, it is part of Jesus' nature to discuss the fact that he was all man as well, not just God. If the Bible declares it, so I must declare it. Jesus was God. He is God, but Jesus was also man, and he did that for you and for me. So while his call as God would be to obey him, to yield to him, because he now possesses all authority in heaven and on earth, his call as a man is to look at the sacrifice he made for you. Look at the suffering, look at the temptations, look at the hardships he faced for you. And the only way you can make that sacrifice not be in vain is to yield to it, to submit to it, to obey it. Do you believe it? He promises that those who would believe it shouldn't perish, because those that believe it should act. Those that understand what he's saying, as he would say in Luke 6 and verse 46, why do you call me Lord, Lord? Do not do the things that I say. He's showing us we cannot believe and not act. We must act. If you believe it. So I urge you, if you're visiting with us today, you need to come to the Lord in baptism, confessing that Jesus is the Son of God, repenting of the things that you've done wrong, not to do them again. You can become a child of God today. If you are a Christian, and you've forgotten the fact that he was sacrificed for you, that he underwent this life, all of the hardships, all of the pain, and then some, because he had to leave heaven for you. He had to leave his home for me. He had to leave a relationship with his father behind, of being there with him for you and me. That's what he did for us. So would you realize the sin in your life and make it right today? If you do, he tells us in 1 John 1 and verse 9 that if we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us of those trespasses. He will blot them all out if you'll yield to him. So I urge you today to do that while we sing an invitation song. We're about to have that song, so if there's anything that you need, please make your way to the front and we'd be glad to assist you. You can do that while we stand, while we sing.